Declaring independence was relatively easy, but now the Americans had to fight for it. And in 1776, the war began disastrously for the new nation. The British pushed General George Washington's raw American troops off Long Island in a day, forcing him to abandon New York, the hinge between North and South. So Washington had to adopt a more cautious strategy, which he explained to his political masters, the Continental Congress.
On our side, the war should be defensive. That we should on all occasions avoid a general action or put anything to the risk unless compelled by a necessity into which we ought never to be drawn. Being fully persuaded that it would be presumption to draw out our young troops into open ground against their superiors both in number and discipline. I have never spared the spade and pickaxe.
The spade, not the sword. Hardly epic stuff. But Washington's strategy made sense. He was fighting professional soldiers, many of them battle-hardened, whereas most of his troops enlisted for one season at a time and then went home to their farms. His was also the main American army, and he couldn't risk its destruction. So he avoided set-piece battles and instead harried the British in guerrilla actions and skirmishes. Some of these he won, more of them he lost. Like most countries, not least the British, Americans celebrate the victories and discreetly forget the defeats. After losing Philadelphia in the autumn of 1777, Washington took his men into winter quarters at Valley Forge in Pennsylvania. The troops lived a dozen in each wood cabin, 14 feet by 16, and their staple food was a delicacy known as fire cake, flour mixed with water and baked in coals or on a stick. Many lacked overcoats and even shoes because the Continental Congress was reluctant to find the money. At Christmas, Washington penned a furious letter listing the problems in his camp.
Not a single hoof of any kind of slaughter, and not more than 25 barrels of flour. Soap, vinegar, and other articles allowed by Congress, we see none of. Few men have more than one shirt, and some none at all. We have, by a field return this day, made no less than 2,898 men now in camp, unfit for duty, because they are barefoot and otherwise naked.
Washington warned the Continental Congress,
unless some great and capital change suddenly takes place, this army must inevitably be reduced to one or other of three things. Starve, dissolve, or disperse, in order to obtain subsistence in the best manner they can.
Washington may have been hyping it up a bit, but that winter was certainly a close-run thing. What helped sustain morale was a severe dose of training, administered by Friedrich von Steuben, who was billed as a baron and a general, though his title of nobility was a fake, and he'd actually left the Prussian army as a mere captain. But Steuben endeared himself to the men, drilling them in full-dress uniform and swearing in colourful German or French. He taught them to speed up their musket fire, to use a bayonet, and to hold formation in attack or retreat. And he also established proper sanitation, with kitchens on one side of the camp and latrines on the other. Previously, men had often relieved themselves wherever they chose. But Steuben didn't try to introduce what he called
the entire system of drill, evolutions, manoeuvres, discipline, tactics and Prussian formation into our army. I should have been pelted had I attempted it, and should inevitably have failed.
He told a Prussian officer,
the genius of this nation is not in the least to be compared with that of the Prussians, Austrians or French. You say to your soldier, do this, and he doeth it. But I am obliged to say, this is the reason why you ought to do that, and then he does it.
The winter in Valley Forge was important for another reason. America was in the grip of a smallpox epidemic, and Washington decided to have his army inoculated. Things could go badly wrong for the victim and for those in contact, yet Washington felt he had no choice, because smallpox was ravaging his troops and they were spreading it among the civilian population. Most of the British redcoats, by contrast, were immune, coming from a country where the disease was endemic. Washington's campaign against smallpox may have mattered as much as his leadership in the field. As Washington struggled to keep his army operational, the first of two military turning points in the war occurred in upstate New York. In October 1777, local militia units surrounded some 6,000 British soldiers under General John Burgoyne at Saratoga and forced them to surrender. Burgoyne had tried to move an army with a huge baggage train through the American wilderness, and he paid the price. Victory at Saratoga boosted American morale and also raised the nation's credibility abroad, crucially in France. Though the French no longer hoped to get back into North America, they were determined to deny the continent to the hated British. From the start of the war, the French had secretly funneled money and supplies to the rebels, and after Saratoga, they signed a full treaty with America, recognizing its independence and declaring war on Britain. Sniffing their opportunity, Spain and the Dutch also joined the French, leaving the British without any major allies. So Britain was unlikely to win, yet its foes didn't seem able to land the killer blow. The war dragged on, and Washington's political battles with the Continental Congress over money and supplies intensified in 1781. Some of his troops marched in protest on their own leaders in Philadelphia, having not been paid for a year, and other units went on strike. One of the soldiers involved, Joseph Martin from Connecticut, explained their grievances.
"For several days we got a little musty bread and a little beef about every other day. But this lasted only a short time, and then we got nothing at all. The men were now exasperated beyond endurance. They saw no other alternative but to starve to death, or break up the army, give all up and go home."
These mutinies usually produced a short-term boost in provisions, but the basic supply problems were never solved. To veterans like Martin, their treatment was rank betrayal for loyal service. To Washington, it proved that the new nation needed a stronger central government. But then came the second decisive encounter of the war, this time in the South. Washington finally abandoned his efforts to capture New York, and with dramatic surprise, marched his own troops and his French allies down to Virginia, trapping the British commander, Lord Cornwallis, and his army on the York Peninsula. The decisive factor was the French fleet, which blockaded the British from the sea and prevented them being reinforced or evacuated. Eventually, Cornwallis was forced to surrender at Yorktown in October 1781. It was a moment of ritual humiliation, and the general himself chose not to appear, leaving that embarrassment to his deputy. American units lined up on one side of the road and the French on the other. Finally, the British marched out of their camp. In Joseph Martin's words,
"All armed, with bayonets fixed, drums beating and faces lengthening, the British paid the Americans seemingly but little attention as they passed them. But they eyed the French with considerable malice. And we saw in the woods herds of Negroes, which Lord Cornwallis, after he had inveigled them from their proprietors, in love and pity to them had turned adrift, with no other recompense for their confidence in his humanity than the smallpox for their bounty and death for their wages. They might be seen scattered about in every direction, dead and dying, with pieces of ears of burnt Indian corn in their hands and mouths."
Saratoga turned the war. Yorktown decided it. Without American courage and endurance, the conflict could easily have been lost. But without French support, the war would have dragged on indecisively for years. After Yorktown, Americans knew that a victorious peace was only a matter of time. And in 1783, Great Britain signed a treaty acknowledging the independence of the United States of America. 7 years had elapsed since the Americans started their fight for freedom. Some areas of the country had been little touched by the war. Massachusetts after 1776, Virginia until the Yorktown campaign of 1781. But other states had been regular battlefields, particularly the Carolinas and Georgia. Around 25,000 Americans died during the struggle, a third in combat and two-thirds from disease. But for Washington's far-sighted policy of smallpox inoculation, the death toll could have been much higher. The main battle had been between Washington's army and Britain's redcoats. But the War of Independence was also a civil war, because about a fifth of white Americans remained loyal to the British crown, and thousands of them fought with the British army. After the peace treaty, these former loyalists settled in Canada or subsided in sad exile in Britain. Blacks fought on both sides, and some slaves won their freedom fighting with the British against the soldiers of American liberty. The war split even families. Benjamin Franklin was a fervent patriot who'd helped Jefferson draft the Declaration of Independence, but his son William was the royal governor of New Jersey, and he became an ardent loyalist during the war. Theirs was a genuine clash of principles, but Ben Franklin took the breach very personally.
"Nothing has ever hurt me so much and affected me with such keen sensations as to find myself deserted in my old age by my only son. And not only deserted, but to find him taking up arms against me in a cause wherein my good fame, fortune, and life were all at stake."
The two Franklins met once after the war, and only so Ben could secure payment for debts owed to him. He never communicated with his son again. But on the level of politics, parent and child, Britain and America, had now to get along in the family of nations. On June the 1st, 1785, John Adams, one of the architects of independence, presented his credentials at St. James's Palace as the first U.S. ambassador to Britain. Bowing three times to the king against whom he'd rebelled, he declared in a voice quavering with emotion,
"I shall esteem myself the happiest of men if I can be instrumental in recommending my country more and more to your Majesty's royal benevolence, and restoring the old good nature and the old good humour between people who, though separated by an ocean and under different governments, have the same language, a similar religion, and kindred blood."
George III, even allowing for his notorious stutter, sounded even more emotional than his former subject.
"I will be very frank with you. I was the last to consent to separation, but the separation having been made and having become inevitable, I have always said, as I say now, that I would be the first to meet the friendship of the United States as an independent power."
Fine words from both sides, but living up to them was to prove much harder.